Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Hurricane Helene devastates western North Carolina and is named the second deadliest U.S. storm in the past 20 years. Over 200 people have died in the southeast. The numbers keep changing, but in North Carolina, 97 was the last number I saw as confirmed dead, with that number expected to rise as rescue efforts continue. The vast majority of those deaths occur in Buncombe County. In some areas, the destruction is catastrophic, with the storm wiping some smaller towns off the map. We have the latest efforts on the damage, the search and rescue efforts, and measures in place to help in a recovery that may take years. Plus, new polling data on Mark Robinson. CMS considers a new student phone policy. The number of fatal overdoses is declining in North Carolina, and Charlotte FC is playoff bound. Here to talk about those stories and more is Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Alexandria Stans is a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning. Welcome to everybody. In talking last week about the approaching storm, which was then named Helene, I mentioned that people in the Carolinas and throughout the southeast were told to be prepared for heavy rain, localized flash flooding, downed trees, power outages. Instead, this storm was a monster, wreaking havoc through Florida and Georgia before ravaging North Carolina and the mountains, parts of South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia. Were we caught off guard? Did the storm morph into something we didn't anticipate? Did we not understand what was coming? What happened, Nick?
No, Mike, this is exactly the forecast that was expected. In fact, the forecasters at the Greenville National Weather Service office put out a letter earlier this week, kind of saying that the forecast was exactly as predicted. What happened, though, is that this storm did two things that I think led to the devastation, destruction that we're now seeing the aftermath of. First is in intensified rapidly. I mean, really fast. It was still kind of a tropical depression, and then it hit that really warm water as it made land, and then it really turbocharged and sped up. And the second thing is it then went through places like the mountains that aren't normally, you know, used to such flooding and devastation. But we knew before the storm hit that there was going to be devastating, deadly flooding in Asheville. I mean, those are the words our meteorologists were using, the National Weather Service meteorologists were using, and that's exactly what we got. But it's kind of hard to fathom the kind of death and destruction
I think that's what I was getting at, because Eli, if you recall, I don't know whether you were here during Hugo or not. That's about 1988-89, somewhere in there. Charlatans didn't understand what they were told, but they didn't understand what it was going to mean. And the same might be true for Asheville and other parts of the mountains. I know that you wanted to comment there, Eli.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think that's exactly right. I was not here for Hugo, but it's difficult to conceive of what, you know, Nick said, dangerous and deadly flooding looks like if it's not in living memory. And, you know, Asheville has been devastated by floods before. This storm is a generational event, but not totally without precedent. You know, if you look at 1916, 1940, there were serious, serious floods in the mountains that look comparable, but there are a few different things. One, a lot more people live there now. You know, these have been really intensely developed regions as more people want a second home and the population grows. They are, you know, havens for retirement. And there's been so much said about the boom in the mountains. There are a lot more people in the storm's way, and it has faded from living memory. So even with accurate forecasts, people find it difficult to conceive of until it's there.
We're going to say this repeatedly through this program, I'm sure, but Buncombe County seemed to have gotten the major portion of the damage. And as of yesterday, the Buncombe County Sheriff, Quentin Miller, said 61 people had been confirmed dead in his county. I should mention that at the same time, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services had that toll in Buncombe County at 25. I'm curious about why there's a discrepancy, and that's a big one.
Yeah, what we've heard so far is that the discrepancy stems from different standards for confirming fatalities and just a delay also in transmitting information and compiling information from the local level up to the statewide level.
Meanwhile, there were 9 deaths reported in Yancey County, 6 in Henderson, 3 each in Madison and Avery counties, 2 in Cleveland, Rutherford, and Watauga counties, 1 death each in Burke, Catawba, Gaston, Macon, Polk, Yadkin, and Mecklenburg counties, all attributed to the storm from various different causes, from drowning to being caught in landslides, being hurt and killed by fallen trees and limbs, and motor vehicle deaths. The Avery County Sheriff, Mike Henley, says he expects there will be more than the three deaths already attributed to the storm in his county.
We hope that's all, but this has been a big event, and to this magnitude, I would say that we'll have some more.
And by this time, everybody has seen the devastation in Asheville. Portions of Asheville and Buncombe County, of course, reported the most deaths. Why did it seem to hit them so hard?
So we know that this is what the forecast was, and we knew to expect this. But it's not clear to me how that mix of this is where some of, but not the most intense rainfall partnered with where the rivers were in Asheville already at flood stage. But, you know, a lot of where we've seen the most devastation in Asheville is along the River Arts District, which is this really vibrant community. And so I think when you look at where the development of Asheville is around the river, and then you look at how bad the river flooded, that was, in this case, quite literally a deadly combination.
Eric, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, well, I was just going to add, and I'm sure we'll get to this as we're going through all the aspects of this, but one of the things that jumped out at me this week is the estimate by Moody's of $34 billion worth of damage. I don't have a North Carolina specific number, but obviously Western North Carolina took a large portion of this storm damage. So yeah, as we're going to say over and over again, months, if not years, and billions of dollars, and just so many different aspects to clean up with this storm.
The situation in Asheville has been described as dire. Buncombe County Register of Deeds Drew Reisinger on Monday said that his office had received 11,000 requests from people seeking help to locate loved ones. Now, we know that the storm washed out roads, took out cell service and internet service, made it difficult to communicate and to get to people and account for people. That was all on Monday. Has anything improved in terms of communications or finding people or helping people in the week that has transpired?
I think that the search and rescue crews are still trying to get past all the obstacles that this storm created. They need to chop down bunches of trees that have fallen to reach people up high in the mountains. There are bridges that are still broken where they can't cross. Mitchell County has a Google Doc where people are writing the names of their family members and trying to find them. They're writing things like, this person is on oxygen and they're running out of the tank and I don't know where they are. So we're definitely still trying to find people. And that's why the death toll is really concerning, because we're already past 200 and it's going to rise as these efforts continue.
Eli?
One thing that I think has been really fascinating to see is the combination of old and new technology that is being used here. With cell towers washed out and communications largely gone, we've seen more than 60 Starlink terminals deployed using satellite internet to help people connect. We've had conversations with people like Zeb Smathers, the mayor of Canton, and Duncan McFadden, a former WFAE reporter who's now in Linville, enabled via Starlink. At the same time, there are teams of people, volunteers, using pack mules to bring insulin to people in the mountains. And we are, literally seeing people using mules and people using satellites to reestablish communications and contact with these communities that have no other way.
And another major problem for many communities up there has been water. Asheville Assistant City Manager Ben Woody says it could take weeks for running water in that city to be restored.
I can't provide a precise timeline as much as folks want me to do that. We are not able to do that. We are still accessing infrastructure that is buried under debris that is perhaps inaccessible because of water that still remains. We are doing that every day as fast as we can.
What seems to be the biggest problem? Why has water service stopped? Is it a power problem? Is it contamination? What is it?
Yes. I mean, okay. In this case, again, it's this as so many things with this storm, it's the nature of what happened and the fact that there's multiple things. So when you overtop, you know, sewage plants and you overtop water processing plants, that can contaminate and lead to knock those things out. We also know that there's not power there. And then on top of that, we know that there are massive problems with the road infrastructure, getting to repair things like power lines and repair things like water and sewage plants as well. And so that is, you know, a combination that leads to weeks of, you know, like we just heard, weeks before they can get the water restored.
Yeah, and in Asheville, the main transmission lines from two of the three water plants that serve that city have been taken out and washed away. And you know, if you've seen crews installing those big, 12-inch, 16-inch, whatever water mains in your street, you know how long it can take to replace just one in your street. Now you're trying to do that for 1,000 feet or so of that in the mountains with the roads washed out. And that's why it's going to take a long time.
And you have to get the pipes. You have to bring them in from someplace. Yeah. The River District, you've already mentioned, it was kind of that's the arts district in Asheville. It was decimated because of they're right next to the river. Another area that seems to have been severely damaged is Biltmore Village. And that's not near the river, but it looked like a rushing, rapid river for a portion of this storm. What are they telling us about the restoration of that?
Well, I've seen an interview recently with the manager there where they said it looked like a river coming through the Biltmore, like you were saying. And, you know, I think it's going to be a lost tourist season for them, as for so many businesses. And that, as Eric alluded to, this economic impact is another aspect of this. We are right at the start of the high country tourist season, apple picking, Christmas trees. There's so many industries that depend on this, and the whole Blue Ridge Parkway is closed right now at the start of leaf season.
What I haven't heard about is how Biltmore Estate survived this. Were they okay? Do we know? Was there damage?
I have not seen that.
I haven't heard a word. Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard that either.
Okay. For a while on Friday morning, the Raleigh News and Observer reports it looked as if Chimney Rock and Lake Lure had been spared the worst of Hurricane Helene, and then the worst happened. A wall of water came rushing down the broad river, wiping out most of the structures along Main Street in the village of Chimney Rock. Did they get any advance warning of what was heading their way?
Yes, I believe they had the flood warnings that Nick was talking about, and more immediate flood warnings as well. But given the geography of Chimney Rock, as many of these small towns, where do you have the flat areas right next to the river? Hmm. You know, that's where the business district is located. That's where the central buildings and local institutions are located. It's all near the river, and when it floods, you can get the people out of the way, but I mean, there's no sandbagging that's going to do anything to help you.
There's nowhere to go. I mean, to Eli's point, there's just nowhere to go. And that's all the video and images make that painfully clear.
Yeah. The village. Go ahead, Alex.
I've asked people a lot this week, like, why didn't you evacuate? Did you think it was going to be this bad? And I think the message everybody's saying is nobody really thought much of it. Like, they just thought we're up in the mountains. We don't get hurricanes. And also a lot of these small towns, they have like 2,000 people. They don't have huge police departments and tons of resources to even prepare for this kind of thing. So I think that played a major role into it.
We'll talk a little bit more about Chimney Rock when we come back. I want to talk about the impact of this on the tourist industry, because for many of these towns, tourism is 100% their industry. And this is the height of tourist season. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Alex Sands is with us. She is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Let's talk a little bit more about Chimney Rock, because the village of Chimney Rock isn't just facing catastrophic damage. It is simply gone. To quote Chris Murray, who's an emergency manager in Pamlico County, who came to help lead teams of rescuers, he said, "There's nothing left. There's just nothing left." That's a quote. Has Western North Carolina, have any towns experienced that kind of devastation from a hurricane or any other kind of storm? Even in 1916, when those floods came through, was it this bad?
I know Biltmore Village suffered, a similar level of destruction then, but again, everything was much more sparsely populated back then, of course. And, you know, I think the level of total devastation and total loss is really comparable to, you know, what we saw in neighborhoods after Katrina, yeah, after Hurricane Andrew in southern Florida. You know, it's in that category.
In Linville, Levin Sutterth, who is the assistant chief at the volunteer fire department there, says the flooding was worse than anything people have ever seen. But it's heartening, he said, to see people coming together.
The blessings have outweighed the tragedy in the sense that for every terrible, awful story I've heard, there have been at least 3 to 5 of just outrageous heroism.
Yeah, emergency personnel conducted countless water rescues in areas where floodwaters lifted entire homes off their foundations and carried them downstream. Part of the heroism, though, is also coming not just from people who are trained professionals, but from citizen volunteers, neighbors helping neighbors. But FEMA and state officials have been working feverishly to clear roads, reestablish communications, bring needed food and water and other supplies to the western part of the state. But this storm left a swath of disaster and damage from Florida through Georgia into North and South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia. Are there enough people? Do we have enough people at FEMA, for instance, to deal with all of this? And this is not the only natural disaster they're dealing with in the country at the moment, and there will be more to come. Florida is bracing for yet another hurricane.
Yeah, and you know, President Biden has activated more than, I believe, 1,000 active duty soldiers from Fort Liberty to assist, in addition to the National Guard and, state soldiers who have been activated already. I think that shows you the depth of the need. That's a pretty significant deployment of federal troops in the Carolinas. You know, if you look at South Carolina right now, there's actually more people still without power in South Carolina than there are North Carolina at the moment. This morning, it's about 280,000 customers in South Carolina are still without power, and I believe about 230,000 customers still without power in North Carolina. I did want to mention how badly South Carolina has been hit. They've had 41 deaths confirmed as of yesterday, which is higher than Hurricane Hugo, which, you know, of course, devastated the region 3 decades ago. There are reports, surveys being carried out, aerial surveys in the Augusta, Georgia, and North Augusta, South Carolina regions that show in many areas 75% of trees have been knocked over in portions of those cities and suburbs. And, you know, the level of, they also don't have running water, and the yeah. level of devastation in South Carolina, especially the upstate, is very, very high as well.
Nick.
Yeah, getting back to your original question, though, Mike, does FEMA physically and you know, just nuts and bolts have enough resources to deal with this? The answer is no, right? Eli just ticked through all the additional resources the federal government has marshaled. But we also know that FEMA doesn't have enough money, doesn't have enough funding to handle this global response. And so lawmakers are aware of that, and they're, you know, working to address that problem. But this is something that continues to occur. Disaster response funding continues to wax and wane as we deal with bigger storms year after year after year, in part fueled, experts say, by climate change.
Eric.
Yeah, well, that last point, I think, is one of the most important. With climate change, I think most of us know that storms are getting more frequent and more intense. And also, to the point of the funding, we saw, I think it was senators from 6 states that were affected, signed a letter calling for some significant funding and legislation in Congress. I haven't seen an amount specified yet. I think obviously that will be very interesting, but all four senators from North and South Carolina did endorse that that push for federal funding.
We touched on this. Everybody's focused on recovery, as is natural, and rescue and bringing immediate needs to bringing supplies and things that are immediately needed. Everybody's focused on that. We touched on this a little bit a second ago, and that is that for very big swaths of these areas in the mountains, they're 100% of their entire economies are based on tourism. And this is the height of the tourist season. And as we heard on Monday in the aftermath of the storm, I think it was Duncan McFadden, our former reporter who was on with us, who was up in Linville, said that a lot of people were there to see the leaves turn. A lot of tourists were already there to see the leaves turn, which is complicating things. It's going to take years to recover from this. What are these communities going to do for money as this happens? And as we all know, when things disrupt stasis, a lot of people aren't going to stick around. A lot of people who built businesses in those areas aren't going to stick around because they can't. So how long might this take? Does anybody know what's going to happen to these communities in the interim?
I don't know. I don't think that anybody knows how long it's going to take, but one statistic that jumped out at me this week is that Asheville alone in the last 15 years, their tourism revenue has doubled to $3 billion annually. So that shows you, you know, intense growth. And when you take that away, as you just pointed out, that's a big part of their economy. But go through all the other small towns who proportionally probably get even more money from tourism. So what do they do? I would say on the aspect of businesses leaving, of course, people will be wiped out or some people just won't want to rebuild. I think that long-term, the one thing about the mountains is it's a beautiful place to live and more people will want to come back and start businesses. But that's a long, long road ahead.
Eli.
Yeah, and I think when you get to total destruction, as we're seeing in places like Chimney Rock, unfortunately, then of course you're talking years, because it's not just, well, we need to get the road fixed and the power back on. It's the road is gone, the buildings are gone, the business owners are gone. And in many cases, when you're talking about leaves and leaf peeping season, as it's called, the trees are gone. So, you know, I was just reading an estimate from App State that at the peak of leaf season, which is generally this month, some 69,000 people a day on average visit the Blue Ridge Parkway and the Blue Ridge Mountains for that. Those are all people who, you know, won't be able to do that because, again, the Blue Ridge Parkway is completely closed. So you're talking about a generational economic hit in addition to the loss of life.
Go ahead, Alex.
FEMA had a call earlier this week that's going back to people getting back on their feet. They really wanted to stress that if you haven't applied for FEMA assistance, that is an option to register. And I believe people can get it's $700 in initial payments or up to that. And that can go to like food, water, baby formula. And then they also are going to assist with like home repairs, things like that. So if you know somebody in Western North Carolina who needs assistance, make sure that they're actually in tune with that and that they go to disasterassistance.gov.
Clearly, the money spent on these areas will have to extend beyond search and rescue and fixing roads and restoring infrastructure. Both President Biden and U.S. Senator Tom Tillis said this week that a new federal funding bill is needed. Congress is in recess, and they weren't planning to come back until after the election. Are they likely to speed that up? And if they come back, whether they come back now or they come back after the election, are they likely to pass this bill or will politics get in the way?
I don't think politics will get in the way because so many of the states affected are red states. So I think that is going to speed this up. And I also think that just as with any disaster of this scale, the pressure, the spotlight, the scrutiny of this is going to likely minimize debate about approving relief money. I could always be proven wrong, but I think it will go fairly smoothly just because of the overwhelming need. It's hard to argue that.
presidents go to these disaster locations because it's optics. It's hands-on. It makes them appear active. They know what's going on. They don't need to go, but it's kind of, they must go. And President Biden delayed coming to hurricane-stricken western North Carolina until midweek, because when presidents come into areas, their infrastructure disrupts everything because they have to have Secret Service and limousines and helicopters and that Air Force One. It's a major problem for these areas when they come. But he arrived, and after an aerial visit this week, he promised the federal government would be there to assist.
The damage is still being assessed, but and many people are still unaccounted for. So I'm here to say the United States, the nation, has your back. The nation has your back. We're not leaving until you're back on your feet completely.
And earlier in the week, Donald Trump was touring hurricane-impacted areas of Georgia when he said President Biden and Governor Roy Cooper were only helping Democratic areas of our state, and also alleged that Georgia Governor Kemp told him that President Biden was ignoring his calls. In an Oval Office virtual meeting with our governor, President Biden was asked about Trump's assertion, and he did not hold back.
He's lying, and the governor told him he was lying. The governor told him he was lying. I've spoken to the governor, spent time with him, and he told me he's lying. I don't know why he does this. And the reason I get so angry about it, I don't care about what he says about me, but I care what he communicates to the people that are in need. He implies that we're not doing everything possible. We are. We are. It's simply not true, and it's irresponsible.
And following his aerial tour in the mountains later in the week, he spoke about where a leader's focus should be in times like this.
In a moment like this, we put politics aside. At least we should put it all aside, and we have here. There are no Democrats or Republicans, only Americans. And our job is to help as many people as we can, as quickly as we can, and as thoroughly as we can.
State lawmakers also generally pass recovery funding in the wake of major hurricanes, and the legislature was scheduled to return to Raleigh October the 9th for a brief session. So two questions. I know that's next week, but for a disaster of this magnitude, shouldn't they already be back in session, or would that be a futile effort given that we don't know how much money is going to be required for this yet?
I'm not sure that October 9th will be the time to do that. You know, generally what they could do is go ahead and pass some kind of interim authority that would allow some additional or authorize some additional spending. But, you know, when you look, unfortunately, North Carolina has had two other major disasters on the other side of the state to as models. And we've really kind of honed up our disaster recovery apparatus in North Carolina. And we've gotten to be kind of experts at administering the most common type of fund, which is, and say it with me three times fast here, CDBGDR. That's a type of federal grant that allows for long-term sustained recovery. And that's after Hurricanes Matthew in Florence in 2016 and 2018. And so I actually, unfortunately, again, the state's well positioned. We have an Office of Disaster Recovery that got off to a very slow start and now kind of is in a rhythm of how to execute some of these types of things. It's all really technical and bureaucratic. And so, you know, we have the apparatus. We're not creating from scratch, and we're going to need some money, but I'm not sure next week it will be the end all be all. Might not even be the start.
Eli, then Eric. Eli, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, you know, given that we have part-time citizen legislators in the General Assembly, you know, roughly a third of them are in impacted counties, and just traveling this week is impossible for many folks. So I think it would be really hard to get them all back to Raleigh. There are going to be some concrete things, like I believe Kathy Truitt, the state superintendent, has said that she's going to request $150 million to help schools in western North Carolina start to recover, rebuild, salvage those that are salvageable. So there will be some concrete asks like that coming up very quickly. At the same time, you know, as much as we want to see politics out of it, this is going to be ultimately a politicized event from many directions, especially since we're 30 days out from the election.
Eric.
You know, it's interesting. I agree with what Nick is saying. It's so hard to even know how much you need, where it's going to go. But the other thing is, just for some context, the North Carolina Reserve Fund is $4.8 billion. I think the emergency fund is $720 million. I mean, that's a lot of money, perhaps, to those of us on this panel. That is a drop in the bucket
drop in the
when we're
bucket.
Talking about billions of dollars. And that's why the federal response is so important in these kinds of disasters.
Hampering a rescue and recovery efforts is the fact that the power is out in substantial portions of Western North Carolina, as are all forms of communications. Let's start with electricity. Benjamin Fries is a German professor at App State in Boone. Earlier in the week, the entry to his neighborhood was blocked by fallen trees and he lost power for days. But he says he felt lucky considering how hard other communities were hit.
So we're still without power, but to be honest, if I look at the news, if I read stories about Asheville and other cities and villages in this county and other counties, I think we were kind of, in quotes, lucky.
The damage to the electrical infrastructure is so vast. Do they have any estimates on how long it will take for everyone to get power back? This could take, what, 2, 3, 4 months, maybe? Longer? What do we think?
Yeah, and so what we've seen, though, is some interim stopgap measures. So, and I thought this was pretty interesting. Yesterday, Duke Energy touted that they rolled out some portable substations, these 200,000-pound things that can act as substations. They brought two of those to near Swannanoa in the western North Carolina, near Asheville region, to replace two substations that were just totally knocked out. And those are the kinds of things that if you don't have a substation, you can't take the high tension power from the high tension lines and kind of dumb it down to get to the distribution lines in a city. And that's what the substations do. But even to bring in these massive substations, they first have to, in some parts, rebuild roads so they could pull in these very heavy substations. And it just illustrates again, okay, we can get you the replacement and temporary infrastructure, but we have to build some infrastructure to get the infrastructure in. And so I think there are some short-term fixes coming and that are have been implemented, but the long-term permanent solutions are going to take a very long time.
We have 40 seconds, Eli.
Yeah, and I should just disclaim my wife works for Duke Energy here. But one thing that I thought was really interesting was a South Carolina Electric Co-op CEO speaking this week said that in their region, they had 1,900 power poles broken and down. It takes a crew of four hours to replace one. So four times 1,900, and that's one small co-op.
Wow. When we come back, I want to talk about the lack of cell service. Some mayors in that area have decried the lack of how weak the cell service infrastructure seemed to be, but it seems unreasonable in a storm like this to be criticizing that. But we'll talk about it. Roads are out and the impact Helene may have on the election all coming up. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE, listener-funded public radio. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Alex Sands is with us from Axios Charlotte, Nick Oxner from WBTV, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Earlier in the week, Canton Mayor Zeb Smathers called the lack of cell service heartbreaking and unacceptable, adding that you're not going to tell me that there weren't things that could have been done better in advance of the storm. Tom Tillis, his spokesman, Daniel Kalin, agrees. He says the telecommunications failures are unacceptable and tragic and something that must be accounted for. It is vital for the state to have plans and infrastructure in place so this failure doesn't happen again during future storms. Given the magnitude of what we just went through, could anything have been done to minimize the damage to communications? Really?
I don't think so. My colleague David Hodges did a first look at this the other day, and he talked with a representative from T-Mobile who gave him kind of a global perspective on you know, why the cell phone infrastructure took such a beating. But, you know, cell towers need things like power. They need things like fiber optic lines to run between them that may have gotten damaged when the earth washed away. And so I think they're probably is some value to the train of thought that, well, we should explore this to see why this breakdown was so bad, because it is. I mean, it's really hampering the people's ability to communicate in these disaster zones. But at the same time, some of it is also, well, this is, everything else was catastrophically damaged. So of course your cell phone network's going to be as well.
Eli?
I'll take a little bit of a different tack on that. When I was a kid, you know, like 30 plus years ago, when the power went out, we had an FM radio with batteries, and we had the landlines kept working, and, you know, that was how you kept in touch. Now we've ripped out that infrastructure that people relied on. Nobody has landlines anymore. About 3 in 4 landlines are gone. Hardly anyone has a battery-powered FM radio or AM radio in their house. We've destroyed the infrastructure that we had before and replaced it with cell phones and internet service. Well, when the cell phones and internet service go down, now it's catastrophic. I think we need to reframe how we think about this. Cell phone towers have backup power, but if they're washed away or the batteries are inundated, that doesn't work. We're going to need to have things like warehouses full of Starlink terminals that can be rapidly deployed in the future to replace communication networks. We're going to have to think about this differently, because the emergency networks we counted on before are largely gone.
And if we had all had landline telephones still today, much of that would have been taken out by this storm too, because if the power lines go down and the poles go down, so do the telephone lines.
Yeah, FEMA, I never understood that when I was a kid. They seemed magical.
Yeah, and well, the phone, when the lines didn't go down, the phones worked because they were battery powered at the front office. FEMA has provided 40 Starlink satellite systems to restore emergency communications. Elon Musk, who owns Starlink, has also offered a number of those systems free for a month. Capitalism, baby. Do we know how many of these in total have been deployed and how they work? Can you just use your normal cell phone and connect to the satellite? Is that how they work?
They provide internet connectivity. So, you know, you could connect your phone to the Wi-Fi and then make Zoom calls or stuff like that.
Of course, the other problem here is that if you don't have power for months and months and months, how do you charge your cell phone?
And that's what I mean by thinking differently. We're going to need solar-powered battery backups. We're going to need a different kind of infrastructure than we're used to.
Yes, and people have been resisting moving to that different kind of infrastructure. We won't name names. I-40 has been closed for days. Part of it reopened on Tuesday morning, allowing Asheville area residents to exit to the east. But I believe that I-40 remains closed to the Tennessee line. And U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg talked about I-40 just recently.
The miles of closure are down below about 40 miles from 100, so definite improvement there. But parts of I-40, North Carolina's DOT is telling us that at best case scenario, it is months before they are permanently restored.
And of course, hundreds of other roads have been damaged, washed away. They don't exist. Bridges don't exist. That'll all have to be rebuilt. NCDOT has said it will take months before any route through the western half of the state really opens. Alex, you reported that Pete Buttigieg also said repair costs will be in the billions and billions of dollars, and that he couldn't predict when roads would become totally passable. At one point, they were asking non-residents and non-essential personnel to stay away from the mountains. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think they're saying, unless you're evacuating, don't go there, because it's going to hamper the search and rescue efforts or any other type of response. And they do need lots of funding. So this is kind of going back to that conversation with the state. Like NCDOT, they can file for emergency relief funding once they figure out exactly what they need, and they don't know yet. That's not clear. And then they know long-term, medium and long-term, they're going to need money from Congress, because the money that the USDOT has in their emergency relief program is just not going to cover all of this.
Nick and Eric. Eric, I think you were first. I don't know. Go ahead, Eric.
Just real quickly, you know, to the point of people going in and out of the mountains. It was interesting. I saw Governor Cooper quoted this week saying, regarding the tourism aspect, don't come. You know, it is anathema for this part of the state to say it, but we don't want you here right now unless you are here to clean up or here to rebuild roads. And so that goes back to what we were saying earlier. Their economy's just devastated. And again, this is the absolute worst time of year for this to happen.
Right. Nick?
Something that was floating around our newsroom yesterday that we covered, and to put a fine point on what Alex is talking about is NCDOT has advised a detour to get from basically the North Carolina-Tennessee line down to South Carolina, which you normally could do on Interstate 26. And it involves going over to I-77, going down south, and then taking 85 back. I mean, it's like hours and hours of detour, but that's just how catastrophic the interstate damage is that's the shortest quote unquote detour that you could get involves, you know, probably two or three extra hours of driving.
Mail-in voting is underway, and we are 32 days away from official election day this morning. That has raised some questions about the impact of this storm on those elections, and North Carolina Board of Elections Executive Director Karen Brinson Bell says there is still a lot they don't know about how this storm affected polling areas and other infrastructure up there, but she still wants to start early voting in Western North Carolina on October 17th.
We don't know this yet, but there may be polling places affected by mudslides. There may be polling places inaccessible because of damaged roads. There may be polling places with trees that have fallen on them.
A significant number of people now live in the mountains of North Carolina. I think 100,000 people live in Asheville alone. Even if they have polling places set up, voting is probably the last thing on most people's minds up there when it comes to mail-in voting. Is the post office delivering? Are they accepting mail? Can you get to a post office or a drop-off point in the mountains?
They're not delivering mail right now. So that's, I mean, obviously they will again. I go back to your first point, Mike. Who's even thinking about an election when all of this is, when your whole life is upside down, you don't know right. Where you're going to live, all those things. And remember, just real quickly, because I know Eli wants to jump in, is in 2020, Trump won this state by 75,000 votes, something like that. So it doesn't take much, as we all know, to swing an election one way or another. This could be a pivotal moment in this race.
And we should point out that Asheville is blue. So if they don't vote, that could lose the state for Harris.
And many of the counties around it, though, are red.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you, Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE, has actually pulled together some numbers from the last election. Donald Trump in the affected counties, the worst affected counties, he won all of those when you put them together, including Buncombe, by 57,000 votes in 2020. So when you look at this area as a whole, it is an advantage for Trump. And, you know, in addition to people not being able to access their polling places, a lot of people are relocating for the medium to long term. You know, people are leaving their houses for weeks and don't know if they'll be back by election day.
Right.
It's probably not a priority to figure out where their new polling place is or how to get a mail ballot sent to their temporary address.
Nick.
Yeah, well, we should point out that, again, we have experience with this. Again, Hurricane Matthew hit, you know, even sooner, closer to Election Day in mid-October in 2016, before that year's presidential race, and then Hurricane Florence again in 2018 in the midterms. And yet we still had elections. We still voted that they, you know, relaxed the rules or changed the rules so that people could get absentee ballots. They, you know, got, remember, Eastern North Carolina was flooded similarly. And we still held election because at the end of the day, we still have elections and that's democracy. And so, you know, I think what you, unfortunately, well, again, we're good at this now.
Speaking of changing the rules, what happens if you are a legal resident in the mountains, but your identification documents, your driver's license, your voter ID was lost somehow in the storm? Will they allow you to vote?
Well, there are many different forms of vote. So two answers to that. There are a bajillion, a long list. I don't even know all of them, of the types of identification that will qualify you to be able to vote. One.
But I mean, if you've lost your house, you've lost your car, chances are you don't have your wallet.
Maybe. Hopefully you grabbed it on your way out. And I don't mean to be glib, but I'm saying, like, right. Hopefully you did that. Two, these are the kinds of things where we know that there is flexibility within, you know, the State Board of Elections and its ability to make temporary rules. But also you can vote a provisional ballot
that
the Board of Elections then reviews and decides whether to accept or not. So that's the kind of thing, Mike, that I have to imagine. We don't know yet, but that I have to imagine you'll see the General Assembly taking up. You'll see the State Board of Elections looking and saying, functionally, how are we going to let people be able to vote like that?
Meanwhile, Eli, and very quickly, the New York Times reported yesterday that Republican lawmakers in Raleigh have for years rejected standards meant to protect against disasters. They say that over the past 15 years, lawmakers have rejected limits on construction on steep slopes, which might have reduced the number of homes lost to landslides, blocked a rule requiring homes to be elevated above the height of an expected flood, weakened protections for wetlands, slowed the adoption of updated building codes, making it more difficult for the state to qualify for federal climate resilience grants. All of this at the behest of the home building industry. The Home Builders Association has contributed $4.3 million to politicians in the state over the last 3 decades, with Republicans receiving nearly twice as much as Democrats. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, actually, over 30 years. But have we heard any response to this?
Well, what the home builders have said, I believe, in that article is that many of these changes were already codified in local regulations and, you know, overseen by the jurisdictions. This is part of a long-running battle between people who want tighter energy regulations, tighter rules about where you can build, and the Home Builders Association. Two things I think are interesting really quickly. One is we're more used to seeing these kind of battles at the coast and around, flood-prone areas. I think the definition of flood-prone area is going to change radically in people's minds and in future legislation possibly going forward. The other thing is that loosening home building regulations is becoming a bipartisan issue over the last few years. You actually heard about it in the vice presidential debate this week. Both candidates were saying we need to cut the red tape and get people building. And I wonder if an event like this might, you know, put the brakes on some of that talk a bit too.
WRL TV reported on Wednesday that Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is running for governor, called on Governor Cooper to help people in Western North Carolina, yet he was the only Council of State member to not vote on Cooper's request to declare a state of emergency in advance of the storm. Evidently, the blessing of the Council of State allows the governor to move more quickly on getting needed help to be deployed. Meanwhile, a new poll, I guess that's another nail in the coffin, I don't know, but meanwhile, a new poll from Elon or from Eastern Carolina University shows what appears to be fallout from the most recent reporting on CNN about some peccadilloes on a nude on a porn site called Nude Africa, allegedly posted by Robinson. The poll shows support among Republicans has dropped 20 percentage points for Robinson, which gives Democrat Josh Stein a 17-point lead. Have other polls supported that trend, or do we know?
Elon was about 14 points a week ago.
That survey period actually ended right before. So this is one of the first polls we've seen that measured post-CNN.
Post-K-File,
A Cook Political Report swing state project survey showed actually an even bigger margin, I believe more than 20 points for Stein as an advantage, showing, I think, more fallout.
Here's all you need to know. He was down double digits before the CNN report, and this isn't going to help him, likely.
Okay, very quickly, we need to end on some good news, because gosh knows the whole show has been really bad news. Fatal overdoses in North Carolina, Alex, appear to be on the decline. This at a time when experts say 7 out of 10 pills that you get on the street contain unregulated amounts of fentanyl. To what did they attribute the decline?
Well, I think it's a little bit of distance from the pandemic, because we know that opioid deaths got really bad during that time. But also it's a good sign that some of the strategies the state has been using are working. We have the $1.4 billion through the opioid settlement. So that money is going towards things like Narcan and syringe programs and other tactics. So still too many people dying, but we've seen a good 23% drop in deaths from April 2022 to April 2023.
And interestingly enough, we are one of two states in the country to have this decline. And the other one, I'm curious about this, but I know there's an answer to this, is Nebraska. Meanwhile, the Panthers lost last Sunday, but that didn't seem to depress people. They saw some hope in that, and they're playing again this weekend with the Bears in Chicago. Meanwhile, Charlotte FC is playoff bound.
Liel into the area, a couple of stepovers. Liel with a shot, and Karim Zsivorski back to goal. Still Abada in the area. Abada will shoot it. He scores! Abada boom! With the exclamation point that no doubt will send Charlotte playoff bound. 4-1 to the ground.
Will Pulitzik on the call for WFNZ on the Charlotte FC Radio Network as Liel Abada scores the goal and puts Charlotte FC up 4-1. The final score was 4-3. We won't know yet for a while when they go to the playoffs or who they're playing. Is that right? That's right. Eric Correct. Spanberg, Nick Oxner, Eli Portillo, Alex Sands, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.